Hey there, sports history fan. Arnie Chapman here from the Sports History Network. Now, before you jump into this episode, I wanted to share with you an exciting giveaway we have going on with Home Field Apparel. We have a digital $50 gift card to homefieldapparel.com for one lucky fan of the Sports History Network. All you got to do is head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways to sign up. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hello, old sports. Welcome to the latest episode of the Hello, Old Sports podcast on the Sports History Network. I'm Dan Newman. I'm joined by my co-host and brother, Andrew Newman. Andrew, how are you doing?
Doing well, Dan. We're starting to get into some fall weather here, and baseball's almost over, and football has gotten started. At least most teams are aware of that. So, yeah, we're heading into a new sports season.
We're recording this on a Wednesday, and we're coming off a very difficult weekend for New York football teams. And say no more. Everybody knows what we're talking about now and forever. But it's good. It's good. September, October is always a good time of year in sports between the NBA or baseball heading into its postseason, pennant races, even though there isn't much in the way of pennant races these days. But that's a different conversation. And obviously the NFL season starting. So it's a lot of fun. And we try to the extent that we can on our show to at least somewhat try and have the episodes match up with what's going on at sports in the year. So this is one of those that I think will be a little bit timely. And it was funny because Andrew had sent me a message a couple months ago. He said that he thought that a good idea for an episode would be the 1948 Cleveland Indians. It's been 75 years since they won the World Series, the last World Series, as a matter of fact, in the history of the Cleveland franchise. And I had actually a little bit before that, you know, a few months before, as I was just thinking about various anniversaries, because we do anniversary shows on this podcast. We did 1998 a couple of episodes ago. We're going to do 1923 a little bit later in the year. We've done others in the past, 1986, 1941, 1920. And I had looked at 1948, and I didn't know that it necessarily was one that merited a whole, 75 years ago, here's everything in sports in 1948. But I thought it was interesting because it was the championship, the last championship for the Indians. It was the third of four straight AAFC titles for the Cleveland Browns, and the Browns were undefeated that year. They were 11-0, and both teams had more than a half dozen Hall of Famers, or at least a half dozen Hall of Famers on the roster. And so I thought it was just really interesting. And it's rare to have an MLB team and a professional football team win the title in the same year. You had the Giants and the Mets in 86. You had the Patriots and the Red Sox in 2004. Going way back, you had the Lions and the Tigers.
The only time it happened, the Patriots win in 13. No, the Patriots didn't win in 13. That was still in their interregnum, right? So what about 18? The Red Sox win in 18?
Yeah. Okay. You're right. So the Red Sox and the Patriots. Yeah, because 18 was when the Patriots beat the Rams in that punt fest Super Bowl. Yeah. So I mean, it does happen. I mean, I'm trying to think. I mean, it obviously it hasn't happened in Chicago. It happened in New York, I guess, in '56 with the Giants and the Yankees. '86 New York Giants and the Mets. I off the top of my head, no other ones really. Really immediately sort of come to mind. Oakland won their three World Series in the early 70s. And then, you know, the Raiders Super Bowl was 76. I guess if you want to be a little bit liberal with the definition of a city, you could look at the Bay Area in 89 with the 49ers and the Oakland A's. But as far as the two outdoor sports, And particularly, you know, in this case and in other cases, too, the two teams playing in the same, you know, the same park, the same arena stadium. It's not, you know, it happens, but it doesn't happen a ton. I mean, I guess if you want to go way back, I know the 27 Giants that won playing in the Polo Grounds won the NFL championship. But as far as like, you know, recently, that doesn't happen all that much, nor would you expect it to. But that was something else that made this kind of interesting to me. And there are some other similarities between the teams that maybe we'll get to in a minute.
So I guess if we're going to do this, we should start with the first team, which would be the Indians. And like you mentioned, this is actually still the last Indians championship. It's funny because for years they were the long running top five around them gradually evaporated, and not necessarily in order, but for years it was the Cubs were the longest drought, 1908. They won in 2016 against the Indians. The Red Sox were always, actually the White Sox were number two, 1917. They were the first ones off the list the second ones off the list winning in 05. And then Red Sox, 1918, they won in 04. The Indians were fourth. There was obviously that big jump between 1918 and 1948 on the list. And then right behind them was the San Francisco / New York Giants, who had last won in 1954, and then they won in 2010. So I don't know who second on the list is now of franchises that are like, you know, have been around. I feel like it might be the Pirates, to be honest, in 1979. Now, that doesn't factor in teams that, you know, have never won it or, you know, have been. But I think of the original 16, they're the ones with the next longest drought. Would be the so anyway, it's, you know, the Indians had a few teams ahead of them and they've all have since won that. And now they sort of occupy an island by themselves.
Yeah, that's a good point. And this is a really, really colorful team. And it's owned by a gentleman by the name of Bill Veeck, who probably is most famous in Major League Baseball for some of his antics as owner a few years later of the St. Louis Browns. He had a tendency to, you see a lot of players jumping around, general managers jumping around, certainly managers jumping around, but it's rare for an owner to jump around. And Veeck, he owned the Indians in the late 1940s, ended up having to sell them as the result of a divorce settlement in about 1950. He then went on to own the St. Louis Browns, and I believe he was the last owner of the St. Louis Browns before he sold the team to a group that brought them to Baltimore. Then he was the owner of the Chicago White Sox in the late 1950s, the Go-Go White Sox, who made the World Series in 1959 and played against the Los Angeles Dodgers and lost. He actually is responsible for two different tenures as White Sox owner. He owns them in the 50s and the early 60s and then has to sell them for health reasons. And then they actually bring him back in the mid 1970s. So some of the things that you may have heard of Bill Veeck doing during his time as an owner, he was the father or the founder or whatever you want to call it of the infamous disco demolition night in the late 1970s, which was for some unknown reason coupled with 10 cent beer night and did not go well. It was led to a, I don't know if a riot is the right word or just sort of a drunken disaster that led to the White Sox forfeiting the game. During his time with St. Louis, he invented Ballpark Manager Day, where fans would be given signs that would say yes, no, pull out the pitcher, steal, that type of thing. And the actual manager was placed in the dugout in an easy chair with a bathrobe and a pair of slippers. He very infamously sent up Eddie Goodell, who was a midget, to bat for the St. Louis Browns, I believe in 1951. Goodell walked on four pitches, and the Major League Baseball then passed a rule saying you could not use midgets in Major League games. And Vec's response was, well, what about Phil Rizzuto? Is he a tall regular person, or is he a short regular person, or a tall midget? I don't think they responded to that. A lot of those antics kind of started after he left the Indians. The other thing that he's famous for, or at least well known for, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, in order for us not to all to entirely just paint him as a clown.
Oh no, he definitely wasn't.
He had a couple of visionary. If he had had his druthers, he would have been the first. He would have moved the St. Louis Browns to the West Coast if it had been up to him, and he would have been the first owner out west before the Dodgers and Giants. But the Yankees owners blocked that deal. He also was at the forefront, and this will come up a lot as we talk about this team. He was one of the most aggressive owners in terms of bringing in black players, and wanted to do it years before he was able to do it. And just to sort of, we've talked about this before, but to button up his time as the Browns owner, his goal as the owner of the Browns was going to be to force, or before he decided to move west, which didn't happen, he knew that St. Louis couldn't support two teams anymore. And as absurd as it seems now, his goal was to force the Cardinals out of St. Louis and have the Browns be this only team in St. Louis. And again, it seems absurd, but you know, the Cardinals owned the ball, or the Browns owned the ballpark. By the late 40s, early 50s, the Cardinals had started to fall on hard times, and he knew the Cardinals ownership was in financial straits and might have a chance to actually force them out. But the Cardinals ownership, instead of selling it to somebody who wanted to move them somewhere, sold to the Bush family, who were not moving out of St. Louis. They were just going to back the team, and he knew right away that his goose was cooked. Tried to move the team out to California, was unsuccessful. The owners basically, spearheaded by the Yankees owners, basically forced him into a sale to the team, the group, the ownership group that moved them to Baltimore. So again, obviously did some promotional things, and maybe some of them were a little absurd or wacky, but also a guy who, it wasn't all gimmicks, shall we say.
Absolutely not. A few things on the integration front. First of all, that is one parallel between these two teams, the Indians and the Browns, is that both were on the forefront of integrating or reintegrating their respective sports. There's sort of a story out there.
But real quick, let me just clarify, because I kind of made this possibly confusing. The Cleveland Browns you're talking about, because I was about him, the owner of the St. Louis Browns.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to be funny, just to clarify that. But yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Yes, exactly. Both the Cleveland Browns, the football team, which we'll talk about in the second half, and the Cleveland Indians, which we're talking about now, were not only integrated their respective, they didn't integrate, but they were a major player in reintegrating their respective sports, but also did so with Hall of Fame guys. For the Braves, or sorry, for the Indians, it's Larry Doby and Satchel Paige. For the Browns, it's Bill Willis and Marion Motley. There's a story out there that Vec had a plan to buy the Phillies in the early 40s and stock the team with Negro League players, you know, Paige, Gibson, Oscar Charleston, those guys, and Cool Papa Bell. And sort of that was scuttled either by the commissioner or by his fellow owners. I think researchers have sort of come to different conclusions as to how serious he was with that plan. But you're right in that he was definitely a very early hero, or a very early champion, I should say, of integration. He was also an amputee. He had served during World War II. He was not wounded, but he suffered an infection while serving in World War II, and sort of tried his damnedest not to have his leg amputated, but eventually had to undergo a couple of different surgeries where parts of his leg were amputated. So he was an amputee based on his time with the war. And he was a guy also who grew up in baseball. His father had been an executive with the Chicago Cubs. He was somebody who was a fan of the Chicago Cubs, later owned minor league teams, where he learned a lot of the things that he would later put into practice in the majors about promotion. and he purchases the Cleveland Indian team in the aftermath. I believe it's in the aftermath of World War II. Yeah, it's in 1946. He sold his interest in the AAA Milwaukee Brewers, and he becomes the owner of the Cleveland Indians, moves them permanently to Cleveland Municipal Stadium, which is a huge stadium with a capacity of well over 85,000. They'd been sort of splitting games between there and I meant to say 70. The capacity is about 78,000 for baseball. It's about 81,000 for football. They had been splitting time between another park known as League Park, which was a much smaller sort of 20,000 seat park. He moves them permanently to Municipal Stadium in the aftermath of World War II and starts trying to build a winner.
I think basically what they would do is once they started playing, you know, they League Park had been their traditional home. Then when they did this split thing, I think I've read that basically weekends and when the Yankees were in town, they would play at the bigger park at Municipal Park, and then every other during the week and against any other team, they would play at League Park. So yeah, the only time they would play there midweek was with the Yankees. So you said he takes over. Just to kind of go over the very briefly the history that they won the World Series in 1920, kind of a transition year that we've talked about. And then second place finish in 21-26. You know, they don't finish like seventh or eighth ever. Those spots were usually reserved for Washington and St. Louis, to be honest, a lot of the time.
And in the 40s, Connie Mack's athletics team is down there, too.
Really by the early 30s, yeah. So 1940, they finish in second. They're just a game out of first place. And then the rest of the 40s, they're in between fourth and sixth place. They finish 80 and 74 in 1947, the year before we're going to talk about. So, you know, certainly not the worst team, not even, you know, they're hovering right around that fourth, fifth spot, which back then was a big distinction. But, you know, let's call it in the 30s and 40s, the American League was pretty much the Yankees and then everybody else.
And they're managed by a guy by the name of Lou Boudreau, who is in the Hall of Fame. He's a Hall of Fame shortstop, a guy who has been the manager of the Cleveland Indians basically for his entire career. He takes over as manager at 24 years of age in 1942. He actually takes over for another former shortstop by the name of Roger Peckinpah, who was a Yankee and a teammate of Babe Ruth's in the early days, who had actually been the manager previously and was replaced by Walter Johnson in the early 30s. And so Boudreau, who wins the batting title in 1944, and they're starting to get maybe a little bit better. Like you said, most years they're hovering around about fourth or fifth place. And Boudreau, and I don't know, I didn't find any details on this, but Boudreau does not serve in the war. I don't know, maybe he has dependents or something like that, but he plays and manages Cleveland all the way through World War II.
I did see this. I got to pull it up. It was not a dependent thing. It was a he was 4F for some reason. Oh, there, here we go. So Boudreau had played and managed the Indians throughout World War II. Playing basketball had put a strain on Boudreau's ankles that turned into arthritis, which classified him as 4F and thus ineligible for military service. He had played basketball in college at Illinois.
So, and actually, it's funny, there's a little bit of a clash in the 47 season between Boudreau and Vec, and Boudreau is almost traded to the St. Louis Browns, but the fans find out there's sort of this public uproar and Vec relents. There was also talk that maybe Vec might try and sort of buy Boudreau out of his managing contract, saying, look, you know, we want you to play, but we don't want you to continue to manage. Boudreau says that if he can't manage, he's not going to play. And Boudreau is kind of a, you know, he's a heck of a player. He's an 8-time All-Star at shortstop. Like I said, he's in the Hall of Fame. He wins the batting title in 44. He's the AL MVP in the year we're talking about in 1948. He's also responsible, or one of the guys responsible, for stopping Joe DiMaggio's hit streak in 1941 in Cleveland at 56 games when he, along with a third baseman on the Indians by the name of Ken Keltner, makes some really good fielding plays in the infield on DiMaggio would-be hits in 1941. So the guy, you know, he's not an all-time great maybe, but he's definitely a legit Hall of Famer, a very, very good player. And so after some back and forth in the 47 offseason, they decide that they're going to keep Boudreau around after he's almost traded to St. Louis, and they go into the 48 season with Boudreau in place as manager for, I guess this would be the seventh year in a row. Do we want to talk a little bit sort of about some of the other stars on this team, or where do we want to take this next?
So I think we should get into some of the stars. I was just about to say we should get into the roster and stuff. I think we should start with Larry Doby just to set the stage of this team. We alluded to it a little bit, but Larry Doby, you know, when I was a kid, I always heard, oh, Larry Doby was the first player, you know, first black player in the American League. I guess I never realized just how soon after Jackie Robinson that was. And also as a kid, I didn't necessarily know why was that such a big deal? You know what I mean? They were very separate in terms of he was playing in front of different cities and different fans for the first time, you know, maybe where Robinson had, you know, it's not like, oh, it was the same teams they were playing over and over again. So in 1947, do you remember when Doby came up?
It was in June. I have it as 8 weeks after Jackie Robinson had started with the Dodgers. And as a lot of people probably know, Robinson started with Brooklyn on April 15th, 1947. So 8 weeks would probably be in that early to mid June time frame.
So he's the second black player in baseball. He breaks the color barrier in the American League. Certainly, you know, not the historical on the historical scale as Jackie Robinson, but, you know, not that long after. I think it's safe to say that opinions on race relations in the country hadn't changed all that much in 8 weeks. He probably got very similar to this is July 47 is when he came up.
Yep. July 5th.
Yep. And he didn't have, like, Robinson had the year in the minors. Yeah. Doby came straight from the Negro Leagues to the Indians directly without, you know, Robinson was signed in 1940. I guess it was like December of 45, actually. Right. And then,
yes,
played 1946 in Montreal, and then 47 with the Dodgers. So he went player Lou Boudreau, actually. I walked down the line, stuck out my hand, and this is in 47, and very few hands came back in return. Most of the ones that did were cold fish handshakes, along with a look that said, you don't belong here. Four of Doby's teammates did not shake his hand, and of those who two turned their backs to Doby when he tried to introduce themselves. During warmups, Doby languished for minutes while his teammates interacted with one another, not until Joe Gordon, who I'm assuming we'll talk about in a minute, asked Doby to play catch with him, was Doby given the chance to engage. Gordon befriended Doby and became one of his closest friends on the team, or at least that's the version that I have here.
Yeah, there's a number of really good books about this team or this season or whatever, is that Joe Gordon, who was recently come to the team himself, and we'll talk about that in a minute, along with Bob Lemon, who's another future Hall of Famer, a pitcher, are the two guys who really sort of greet Doby warmly. Doby had been playing for the Newark Eagles in the Negro Leagues. Newark Eagles, and he's a born and raised Jersey, you know, New York City area guy. The Eagles are owned by Abe and Effa Manley. And Effa Manley, who it might be a name that's familiar to some baseball fans, she is the only woman in the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. She was the sort of the day-to-day owner of the Newark Eagles of the Negro Leagues in the 1940s. And one of the differences between Bill Veeck and Branch Rickey, and I'd really love to do an episode one day about sort of not integration, but like not necessarily baseball integration, like on the field, because that's in a lot of ways been done to death. But there's so much as far as the business interactions between the various entities involved, the teams, the league, the teams in the Negro Leagues. Branch Rickey had a very dim view of the Negro Leagues. He thought that they were run by racketeers. He made no bones about basically just stealing their players. Vec was a little different. Vec wanted to compensate teams like the Newark Eagles, whose players he was taking. So there's a difference there between the way Vec goes about integration and the way Branch Rickey goes about it. Doby comes up. They don't really have a position for him. They put him at first base for a while, replacing a guy by the name of Eddie Robinson, who we've mentioned Eddie Robinson. And we actually did him on an in memoriam. Eddie Robinson is a guy who in his career plays with seven different American League teams, including the Yankees for a couple years, actually lives to almost the age of 101. Eddie Robinson, here's an interesting thought about Eddie Robinson. He was replaced temporarily at first base by the first black player in the American League. By the time of his death, he has his own podcast. So that is a guy who sees a lot of American history. But he's replaced by Doby briefly in 47. Doby does not have a good year up with the Indians in 1947. He appears in 29 games. He has 33 plate appearances. How many games does he actually start here? Let me just look that up here. It's very limited. Just bear with me here for 1 second. He actually hasn't. I'm sorry. Hold on here. This is okay. He actually only starts one game. I'm sorry. So he really doesn't replace Robinson in any meaningful way at all, even though maybe he's viewed as a temporary replacement for Eddie Robinson. Here are his numbers. He has 32 at bats, 33 plate appearances. He bats 156, doesn't have any home runs, two RBIs, only five hits, one extra base hit. So he really struggles not only to be accepted by some of his teammates, but he also struggles at the plate in the 1947 season with Cleveland.
So we mentioned Joe Gordon. Should we go to him now and talk about him as the starting shortstop of this 1948 Indians team?
We should not talk about him as the starting shortstop. We should talk about him as the starting second baseman, because that's what he was.
Oh, edit that out.
I will. Yeah, so you mentioned Joe Gordon, and Joe Gordon had been with the Yankees. He had come up to the Yankees in 1938. He had replaced another Hall of Famer in Tony Lazzari, who had been with the team going back to the Ruth years, and he had replaced Gordon. He had replaced Lazzari at second base and been on the tail end of the Gehrig DiMaggio teams, and then been with the team through the 1940s. He misses 2 years for World War II in 1944 and 1945. Joe Gordon wins the American League MVP award in 1942 with the Yankees with a .322 batting average, 18 home runs and 103 RBIs. Do you know what's so crazy about this 1942 American League MVP race?
I feel like there was somebody who clearly had a great year that it should have gone to. Is that the case?
Ted Williams won the Triple Crown that year.
Yeah, I feel like we talked about that. I was going to say I thought Ted Williams did something, but then in my head, I'm like, oh, no, was he over? Was he fighting by then? But yeah, that was very clearly because they didn't like him, right?
He was fighting. It was with the sports writers, not with the Axis powers.
Yes.
Yeah, Ted Williams, 36 home runs, 137 RBIs, both best in the majors that year, and then .356 batting average. So if anybody thinks, number one, that writers aren't vindictive, number two, that writers being vindictive is a new thing, then please be aware of both of those facts. By the post-war era, Gordon is starting to get sort of disgruntled with the Yankees front office, which, if you know anything about the Yankees front office of the mid-1940s, and we've talked a little bit about that whole situation a little bit, you can understand why he's over 30. But Vec and Boudreau, they take a chance on him. They trade him. They trade for him prior to the 47 season. They trade away a pitcher by the name of Allie Reynolds, Super Chief, who, in addition to being on the Indians, is also part American Indian. And he, Reynolds, for his part, goes on to win 6 World Series with the Yankees and is considered sort of a borderline Hall of Famer. In fact, the last time that there was a Veterans Committee ballot for that era 2 years ago, the year that Gil Hodges and Buck O'Neill and some of those guys got in, the year that we went, Allie Reynolds was one of the players on that. I think it was 12 or 16 person ballot. So that's the trade. They acquire a Hall of Fame second baseman in Joe Gordon, and they pair him with the manager, the player manager, Lou Boudreau, and they have a Hall of Fame double play combination going into the 47 and then the 48 season.
So you have him. We mentioned, you know, we talked about Boudreau. That's your middle infield. We talked about Larry Doby. You mentioned Eddie Robinson, the first baseman. Keltner, the third baseman, the guy who robbed DiMaggio 7 years earlier, kind of completes the infield. Outfield, I see Dale Mitchell was one of the other outfielders who started 140 games that year. And then, you know, 8 of the 9 position players started at least 120 games, and in most cases, many, many more than that for the team. So remarkable consistency, except for, I guess, that last outfield spot seems like it had a different, a bit of rotation in there between, they list Thurman Tucker as the outfielder in the starting lineup officially, but Allie Clark got nearly as many, actually more plate appearances. Hank Edwards got quite a few plate appearances, but the rest of the lineup really remarkably consistent.
Dale Mitchell, who, we should tell a little story about Dale Mitchell. You know what Dale Mitchell is probably best known for.
Do I?
He was the last out of Don Larson's perfect game.
Oh, okay. Okay. I can't say I would have made that connection immediately. So
spends most of his career with the Indians, goes to the Brooklyn Dodgers midway through the 56 season, and ends up pinch hitting for the pitcher in the, with two outs in the bottom of the ninth against Don Larson in the 56 World Series. This is a story that I just found out a couple of months ago when I went to the Yogi Berra documentary. Yogi Berra's wife was pregnant in the stands, and when Dale Mitchell came up, Don Larson, you know, facing Don Larson with Yogi Berra as the catcher, she says, if Larson gets him out, I will name our child, our son, I think maybe they knew it was a boy at that point, I will name our son Dale. And sure enough, she names their son Dale, and Dale Berra is the one of the Berra boys who makes it to the major leagues himself, actually plays for the Yankees for a while in the 80s. So little story there about
Why Dale. Why did you name the kid after Don Larson?
I don't know the answer to that.
Instead of the last guy who got house.
Maybe she didn't like the name Don. I have no idea.
So, okay. Wonder what she would have named him if he got on base.
So, and then you have the pitching staff, and, you know, first off, you got Bob Lemon, who's a Hall of Fame pitcher. He's actually originally a position player. You mentioned that he is one of the guys who greets Larry Doby warmly along with Gordon in the 1947 season. He had actually originally been a position player, and he had actually been up very briefly with the Indians prior to the war. And here's a story that I didn't realize. Any player who'd been in the majors before the war, who had served in the war, was entitled to 30 days on the major league roster in 1946, once they came back, which was, I guess, kind of a nice thing to do. And the Indians are in New York City playing the Yankees early May of 46. And Bill Dickey, who's actually, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Not to be funny, but like, if a guy got his leg blown off in the war, was he still entitled to 30 days on the roster?
I'm sure he wouldn't have wanted to play.
But I mean, if he would have gotten paid for those 30 days,
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. Maybe there was some provision to, you know, exempt the clearly physically unable. I don't know the answer to that question, but it's an interesting.
They all had to go to the senators or something like that. But anyway, go ahead.
So early May, we've talked a little bit before about how 40, and again, not to keep bringing up the Yankees, but Joe McCarthy's quit the Yankees and they Bill Dickey is acting as manager. The Indians pull into New York and Bill Dickey pulls Boudreaux aside and suggests that they turned Bob Lemon into a pitcher because Lemon had been, I guess he was pitching a little bit during World War II. And Dickey had been serving in Hawaii with Lemon, maybe managing the team or something during World War II. So they convert Lemon into a pitcher and he goes on to have a Hall of Fame career. So right off the bat, you got a Hall of Fame owner in Vec and you got Hall of Famers in Boudreaux as player manager, Joe Gordon, who they just traded for, Bob Lemon and Larry Doby, who has just integrated the American League. And then, well, I guess technically you have two more, but we'll talk about Satchel Paige in a minute. And then you got Bob Feller. And I feel like we should spend a couple minutes on Bob Feller because Bob Feller is like as close as you can come to a sports celebrity in sort of the early major media days of the 1940s. Bob Feller is really that guy. And also he's probably the best and the fastest pitcher to date when he comes up to the Indians he never pitches a day in the major leagues, or I'm sorry, never pitches a day in the minor leagues. They sign him at the age of 17 in 1936. Doesn't really come into his own until about, I guess you could say 38, when he leads the major league in strikeouts as a 19-year-old. And then he really comes into his own in 1939, 24-9, 24 complete games, 246 strikeouts. 1940, he wins the pitching triple crown, 27 wins, 2.61 ERA, 261, leads the majors in strikeouts in the 4 years prior to the war, leads the majors in wins in the 2 years prior to the war. In 1938, as a 19-year-old, on the very last day of the season, with Hank Greenberg coming in to face Cleveland with 58 home runs and a chance to beat or tie Babe Ruth's record only 11 years after Ruth set it, Feller has one of the all-time great pitching performances against Hank Greenberg. I believe he strikes him out twice and sets a brand new record for American League strikeouts. Let me pull up that game. Yeah, complete game for Feller. He strikes out 18 players, which is a record that survives, I think, for decades. He strikes out Greenberg. Let me see how many times he strikes out Greenberg in that game. He strikes out Greenberg twice in that game. He strikes out one guy five times. That guy must have felt great. And so Feller is a phenom. When he graduates from high school, NBC Radio broadcasts Bob Feller's graduation on national radio from coast to coast. He is one of the first major league players to enroll in the military, enlist in the military after the Pearl Harbor bombing. He misses three full seasons, 42, 43, and 44. While serving in World War II. He comes back and starts nine games late in the season in 45, has another really, really good season in 46, 26 wins, 348 strikeouts, which is, God, if that's not close to the, I got to look up and see what the single season record is, but that's got to be damn close to it. So this is a guy, 1946, 1947, he's kind of considered one of the greatest pitchers of all time.
Yeah. And I just wanted to, the 3 years before the war, and this was pre Cy Young award, but he finishes third, second, and third in the American League MVP. In 39, he's behind DiMaggio and Jimmy Fox. In 40, he's behind Greenberg, and then in 41 he's behind DiMaggio, the year of the 56 game hitting streak, and then he's behind Ted Williams, who hit 400 that year. So, you know, he is, before losing basically 4 years of his career to World War II, when you factor in 45 he barely pitched, you know, after he came back. So 46, he doesn't pick up right where he left off, but he's still a very, very, you know, dominant pitcher, especially in 46 and 47. You know, and by the time we get to the 48 season, he's only 29, but he's been in the league not for 13 years, but since 1936.
The vast majority of guys, that 1946 with 348 strikeouts, that's 19th all time for a single season. The vast majority of guys ahead of him on this list are guys from the 1800s. Nolan Ryan had 383 in 1973. Sandy Koufax, 382 in 65. Randy Johnson had a couple of really good seasons, 372 one year and 364 another year. You got a Nolan Ryan season in there, but the vast majority of these guys are from the either the 19th or the very early 20th century. So
there was also a year Adam Dunn struck out at least that many times.
They should count that. They should put the hitters in with the pitcher. If you're that bad, wouldn't it be great if like they had presented him? It's like, you had more strikeouts this year than Sandy Koufax in 1962.
Sorry, go ahead.
But he is starting to struggle a little bit, Feller. And he's actually, by the time the 48 season rolls around, he's actually getting booed a little bit. And part of that was it was something to do with the All-Star game. I think, I don't remember the specifics of the story, but I think he declined to go to an All-Star game or something in 48. But he is really starting to get booed a little bit for his poor performance. I'm just trying to find the, yeah, he Feller withdrew from the All-Star game in 48. This history of the Indians described him as, quote, throwing home run balls and losing games. They start to resent him. He's making $80,000, which is one of the highest salaries in the major leagues. He also made a ton of money with barnstorming. And it says here, Feller was booed whenever he had rough going on the mound. It was psychological booing, but it sounded like the same old inverted huzzah. I don't know what that's referring to, but I think I don't know. That's something to do with the fact that, you know, he's making this much money and he's getting booed. So Feller's best years, unfortunately, are really sort of behind him by 48. He guy sticks around for a long time. He only has one more 20 game win season in 1951. He's on the World Series team in 54, but he's kind of like a fourth or a fifth starter. So at 29 years of age, and after almost four full years serving in the military, Feller, who would have 300 wins, he's got 266 wins all time. He is an all time great. He kind of like Ted Williams or even DiMaggio would be considered even more of an all time great, but is kind of, he's hurt a little bit by the war, and he's, like I said, he's starting to get booed a little bit in the 48 season, both for snubbing the All-Star game and for his on the field performance.
And before we get into sort of the chronology of the year, he did still go 19-15 with a 3.56 ERA. So he still did have a year that most guys would kill to have, and pitched 299 innings, but compared to the years he had immediately before the war, you don't want to say he's a shell of himself, but he's not he's dropped off significantly from those years.
And the other Hall of Famer that we should mention is Hank Greenberg, who is not on the team as a player. He'd been acquired in the offseason with the intention that he might play a little bit, but he ends up deciding instead to sort of transition into a front office role with the team. So that it could have been even one more Hall of Famer, Hank Greenberg, on the team. So, and we should also mention that Bob Hope is a part owner of the Cleveland Indians, just as his good friend Bing Crosby is a part owner of the Pittsburgh Pirates. And that leads to many a comedy sketch between the two in the 40s and early 50s. So Yeah, it's an exciting pennant race this year. It goes down to the last game of the year. It's close. Indians have some interesting moments during the season. So I've got a couple things I wanted to just sort of mention, but I'll let you mention something first if you have anything.
So a couple of things. August 3rd, there's four teams that are even for first in the American League. So half of the league has the exact same record on August 3rd in the race. By September 9th, they've fallen to 80 and 53. They're in third place. They're 4.5 back with 21 left. By September 14th, with only 15 games left, they're still 4 back and in third place at 84 and 55. They then go on a 7-game win streak to tie it up with 8 games left to play. And before we get to sort of the last day of the year, I'll give it back to you and you can go over some stuff. But I just figured I'd sort of the chronology. It was a really close race. They were behind in mid-September. They went on a nice tear and put themselves in position right at the end.
So one of the things that Avec does during the year is the signing of Satchel Paige, the all-time great pitcher of the Negro Leagues, most notably with the Kansas City Monarchs, but really with a number of teams in the Negro Leagues throughout the 20s, 30s, and 40s. A man who we'll have to do an episode where maybe we talk more about Satchel Paige, but a man of sort of larger than life. He's a character, a man of indiscriminate age, who Baseball Reference lists him as having been 41 during the 1948 season. But I mean, he could just have easily have been, you know, in his mid to late 40s or possibly potentially younger, most likely older. They signed Paige. Part of the reason that they signed Paige is for the gate, you know, Bill Veeck, always a showman. Part of the reason is because people think that maybe he wants another black player to go with Dobie. And part of the reason is that they need pitching because Feller is struggling and they, you know, like you said, they're in a very tight pennant race. Paige makes his debut with the Indians on July 9th, 1948, which is, you know, right in the thick of this pennant race, probably either just before or just after the All-Star break. And he's really the only, and I'm sure there's a few others you could point to, but when you talk about the greats of the Negro League, sort of the pantheon Negro League guys, Josh Gibson, Oscar Charleston, Cool Papa Bell, Buck Leonard, Smokey Joe Williams, you know, those type of guys. The only one who really ever makes it to the major leagues, especially the only one who really makes it for more than just a very brief sort of cup of coffee type of thing, is Satchel Paige.
And it's very good that this was able to happen, because Paige is Paige is another one who people talk about, but it's almost like Yogi Berra or Casey Stengel, where they talk about what he did for 2 minutes and then it devolves into folk tales, many of which are entertaining, some of which probably have some serious truth to them. And I understand the reasons for this, I'm familiar with the reasons for this, but a lot of the Negro Leagues, yeah, there were records and yeah, there were stats, but then there's a lot of, I don't want to say legend, but sort of you don't know where the story ends and where the storytelling begins. You know what I mean? So it's almost good, or it is good. And unfortunately, obviously, that it happened when he was 42 years old, but he got to, even at 40, come up and prove factually what he was capable of, even then, even briefly. You know what I mean? Like, a lot of those other guys, you mentioned Gibson and Bell and all the sort of guys associated with the 30s and 40s in the Negro Leagues. We know the Negro Leagues were a high level of play. but it's very hard to fully contextualize from a baseball standpoint. So I think it's good that we have, even him at his tail end, there's something tangible to grab onto, or more tangible, I guess. You know what I mean? Does that make, what I'm saying make any sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And he, we'll talk a little bit. You can overstate it. You can say that, well, you know, they wouldn't have won the 48 pennant if it wasn't for him. Hard to say, although given the fact that they won it in a one-game playoff, even sort of the fact that he was able to swing a couple of games would have really helped them win the pennant. But yeah, he is a key contributor on this team. This is really sort of his only true, I hate to use this word, but his only really true good major league season. He's back with Cleveland in 49 for, I guess, what could best be called a mediocre season in relief. Then he's back. I think he's back in black baseball in 50. And then he's got a couple of okay years in the early 50s with St. Louis, and then comes back and pitches a game for the Kansas City Athletics in 1965 at the age of, what was he, 59 then? 58, you know, with another sort of bombastic showman of an owner in Charles Finley. But yeah, he contributes. They sign him, and a lot of people in the press are critical. The Sporting News writes that, quote, to sign a hurler at Page's age is to demean the standards of baseball in the big circuits. And somebody says, if Page were white, he would not have drawn a second thought from Vec. Vec responds, well, if he was white, he would have been in the major league 20 years ago and the conversation wouldn't have taken place, which I thought was sort of a perfect response. He says, I signed Page because I think I can help us, not because we need publicity. Although I do think that it is worth noting that Page very much does help with selling tickets for the Indians.
He's only the fourth black player in baseball. You have Robinson and Campanella in Brooklyn, and then Larry Doby and him.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. Well, there's a guy, Dan Bankhead. He might be the third, not Campanella. Dan Bankhead appeared for the, but he's in the top like five or six. There's no question about it. One ticket agent located in Akron, Ohio said, I had 800 tickets for a game. They were moving like molasses. Then it's announced that Page will pitch. In just 22 minutes, I sold out the 800. I sent for another 700. People lined up outside the place. By noon Monday, those were gone. So I hurried to Cleveland Monday night. They gave me what they could, 600, and then those were gone. In Akron, Ohio, all they needed to say was Page is going to pitch, and they sell 2,200 tickets for this one specific game that he's talking about. Page, obviously is different than Robinson or Doby or some of these other early integrationist, you know, players who are integrating the game. He brings a reputation and a way of doing things that he can get away with that some of these younger guys, you know, these younger black players are not really able to get away with. He's got nicknames for some of his teams. He calls Bob Feller Bob Rapid. He calls Lou Boudreau Mr. Lou, which is not particularly creative. And he calls Bill Vec Burrhead. And so very different personality, especially than Doby.
Yeah. And you know, than Robinson and really anybody that they've seen so far. You know, and there's always been sort of the question of how much was he playing that up for the press, you know, sort of the countrified, you know, gangly, you know, guy with the sayings and things like that. But on top of everything else, there's no doubt that he knew how to market himself in an era when a lot of players were not concerned with that, especially, let's be honest, black players who, you know, especially when they came into white baseball, were, you know, told to behave a certain, really when any black athlete came into white sports at that time, was told to behave a certain way and not rile people up. And not that Page was riling people up, but he also was being, you know, he was not avoiding being himself. He was avoiding red meat because that angers up the blood, but he was not avoiding, you know, the spotlight or the limelight, I guess.
Makes his debut on July 9th after an overworked Bob Lemon pitches four innings and gives up four runs. And let me just see if I can get the stat line from Page's very first game with the Cleveland Indians. He pitches two innings, gives up two hits, no runs. It's another 6 days before he appears in another game in relief. Eventually, he does become a starter. How many games does he start for the team on the year? I see one, two, three, four, five, six. It looks like about seven or eight games for the team on the year. Ends up with a 6-1 record, including a couple of shutouts, one of which I want to highlight a little bit more in a second. So, yeah, I mean, this is not an otherworldly season for Satchel Paige, but he puts in a really, really good performance, especially for a guy facing what he's facing at his age, you know, and is a key part of this this American League pennant winning or this World Series winning team with the Indians in 1948. I have a couple of other things. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Real good. Thing, pitching in a race too. There's a difference between, you know, getting called up, or I keep saying called up. You know what I mean? Like getting brought into Major League Baseball. You know, if he'd been playing for a seventh place team that was only using him to sell tickets and, you know, wasn't worried about whether he won or whether the team won. They were using him to try to win an extremely tight race against other teams. You know, you figure if it was a four-team race, at least half the games are against the teams they're in a race with, or, you know, close to half the games are against teams they're in races. So they didn't just have the luxury of throwing him out there so they could sell tickets to the black fans and, you know, get some publicity. They needed him to pitch effectively, or probably wouldn't have kept throwing him out there just because it meant good attendance if he was ineffective.
So mid-August, they win eight games in a row from August 12th to August 20th. And on August 15th, they're in Chicago to play the White Sox. Bob Feller wins the first game of the season of the doubleheader 6-2. And then Bob Lemon, his fellow Hall of Famer, shuts the White Sox out 8-0 in the second game. It's Lemon's seventh shutout of the season and his 16th win of the season. 2 days later, they're playing the lowly St. Louis Browns with flags flying at half staff to honor Babe Ruth, who had just passed away. Mm. And a pitcher by the name of Gene Bearden shuts out the White Sox 8-0 to get the second straight shutout and deliver a 12th win. It's his fourth shutout of the year. And then the following game, a journeyman pitcher by the name of Sam Zoldak blanks the Browns 3-0, and Allie Clark scores all three runs in that game. And so then the final day on August 20th, they defeat the White Sox 1-0, and the crowd at Municipal Stadium is 78,832. The starting pitcher for the Indians is Satchel Paige, who had pitched another shutout. So this is what now, you know, four shutouts, five counting this game, that they've pitched basically in a little over a week. Record attendance, and Satchel Paige shuts out the St. Louis Browns 1-0. It is the fourth shutout. The team sets a record, I believe, for consecutive scoreless innings. Somewhere in the 40s, because Feller had shut out the White Sox during the last several innings of his victory, you know, in the first game of that doubleheader. The overall shutout run is 39 innings. It's the first time there have been four straight complete game shutouts for the Indians since 1903. Unfortunately, both the winning streak and the scoreless streak, the shutout streak, all of it ends the following day with a 3-2 defeat to the White Sox. But anchored by Lemon, Feller, and at least for a while, Page, three Hall of Famers, this is a really, really good Indians pitching staff. The other thing that we should mention is that Bob Feller, after sort of a mediocre 1948, really comes alive in September of 48, in the last month of the season. He, in eight starts in September, he allows 9 earned runs, he never takes a loss in any of his 8 starts, and he has won back the affection of the Cleveland fans. They end up going into the last game of the season up a game on Boston, but Boston wins in the last game of the season. The Indians lose, and so they go into a one-game playoff in 1948 between the Indians and the White Sox to decide the AL pennant.
So they go into the last weekend of the year, and the Yankees are still involved in it, too. The Yankees are playing the Red Sox, and on October 1st, on October 2nd, Cleveland wins, so they clinch at least a tie, and then Boston beats the Yankees, which eliminates the Yankees with one day left in the season. So Cleveland can do no worse than a one-game playoff. The Yankees, who have just been eliminated, understandably do not go out and give the Red Sox, with a chance to end the Red Sox season, they don't deliver. So the Red Sox win, the Indians lose. There'd been a coin toss earlier in the week, or about a week earlier. Presumably the Yankees would have been involved too if they were still in it that late, but the Red Sox had won the coin toss the week before as to if there is a game 155, who will host it. So that sets the stage for Monday, October the 4th, 1948 at Fenway Park. The Boston Braves, I didn't until just now connect that, but we were one game away from a possibility of a Subway Boston's, whatever they would have called it, in Boston in 1948.
Yeah, and there never was one when there were two teams in Boston, nor was there ever one in Philly when they had two teams. I guess in 44 you had two in St. Louis, right? You had the Cardinals against the Browns. You had one in Chicago in 06 between the White Sox and the Cubs. And there's still, could be one still to this day in Chicago. But outside of New York, there's been very few. And I guess if you want to count the Bay Area series of 89 when there was the earthquake, there have been very few of these same city series. But you're right, you almost had one in Boston in 48. And as somebody who went to school, on that campus, those two ballparks, those are walking distance. That's like probably just about a mile. And Yankee Stadium, the Polo Grounds are close, but that's across the river. That would have been a really close series geographically.
Yeah, the Polo Grounds and Yankee Stadium is walking distance, though, or was walking distance. There was a bridge right there. And the way I know it was walking distance is John McGraw made his team do that in 1923. But before we get to that, even though it didn't happen, so there's nothing to get to, they play that game. It's not a tremendously suspenseful game. Each team scores a run in the first inning. The Indians explode for 4 runs in the fourth to give them a 5-1 lead. They end up winning the game 8-3. Gene Bearden is the winner. It's his 20th win of the season. Boudreau, Keltner, both homer for the Indians, and they are headed to their first World Series in 28 years.
The most famous aspect of that one game playoff is that Joe McCarthy, who had won, what did he win? I think 7 World Series with the Yankees, mm-hmm. 7 World Series and 10 pennants, or 8, whatever he won. He won a ton of World Series and a good number of pennants too. He's by this time the manager of the Boston Red Sox, and he decides to start a journeyman reliever by the name of Denny Gailhouse, who everybody thinks it's going to be Mel Parnell, who is the ace of the Red Sox staff, but Gailhouse
Parnell is also beaten the Indians three times that year, by the way.
Yeah, and everybody thought it was going to be him. Gale House is a righty. Pardell is a lefty, and McCarthy decides that he's going to go with righty because he thinks that with the wind blowing out to left field, that the elements are against the left-hander, and Parnell does not realize till he gets to the game that he's not pitching, that Gale House is pitching. His teammates are demoralized. Like you said, it's tied early on, but it's never really a close game. McCarthy is forever second guessed for the starting of this Denny Gale House in this one game playoff. Indians win and they go to the World Series against the Boston Braves.
And this is the only one of these, by the way. This is the only American League playoff game that happened in this era, you know, in the original eight team era. Interestingly, both leagues, because if you're thinking about 3 years later, the Giants and Dodgers finished tied and they played a three game series.
I know where you're going with this.
I would have thought. Like, I remember when I first read about this, not this time, but years ago, I was like, oh, did they change the rules in that couple of years? Each league had a different standard for it. So the AL would only play a one-game playoff, and the NL would play a three-game playoff as they did in 1951.
Yeah, I'm thinking there was definitely one of these in 62 in the National League.
In the National League, yeah.
Which was always, and that was also the Giants and the Dodgers. I don't know. Has there ever been one of the, I don't know if I could pull it up real quick to see. Okay. So 46 Cardinals and Dodgers, and this one in 59 also too. The Dodgers are involved in basically every single one of these in the National League. 59, the Dodgers beat the Braves in two straight games. To go to the World Series, and then they beat the Dodgers, or they beat the Giants in a 2-3. That's that one actually ends. I think that was that the one that ends on a game, a walk-off walk. I could be confusing that with another one. Yeah. And then I guess by the time you get to divisional play, everybody's just doing one game. But yeah, this is the only ever American League pennant one game tiebreaker where the winner goes to the World Series.
So they head to that World Series. We mentioned they're going to take on the Boston Braves, who are a little bit of a surprise to be there, I guess. You know, it's been the Dodgers the year before. It had been this was the Braves' first pennant since 1914, right?
Yeah, Braves first since 14 and the Indians first since 20. Yeah, and this is the last one for the Braves in Boston. They leave Boston only about 5-6 years later.
Yeah, they're gone 5 years later. The series, as they did back then, rotated year to year. So the first two games are held at Braves Field in Boston. And if you want to stop me on any of these, you can. But game one is a 1-0 Braves win. And then game two is a 4-1 Cleveland win. So they split the first two games in Boston.
No off days.
Yeah.
And I don't think they were doing that every single game, every single season. I think it would have been particularly difficult to do that for the St. Louis series because that was more than a 1-day train ride. And St. Louis was in it, you know, 42, 43, 44, 46. But I guess Cleveland and Boston were considered close enough together that they didn't need any off days. So you'd finish up a game, you know, late afternoon and then travel at night and get to the other city and play a game the next day.
I guess. Yeah. I mean, that's still rough, but it's not at least it wasn't like when they were going back and forth every game or something like that, like they did in the NBA back in the day in the playoff series. So they head back to Cleveland for the next three games. Again, the series is tied at one. In game three, the Indians win 2-0 again behind Gene Bearden. No home runs. It's the third straight game. There's yet to be a home run in the series. So the Indians take a 2-1 lead. Saturday, October 9th, the Indians win 2-1. Again, there's home runs in this game, one by Larry Doby for the Indians and one by Marv Rickert for the Braves. But it is a 2-1 affair, and the Indians are now up 3-1 and on the doorstep of their second world championship and first in 28 years.
Couple of things. Johnny Sane, who is part of the famous Spahn and Sane duo of the Boston Braves, defeats Bob Feller 1-0 in game one. Feller is almost unhittable, but the Braves manage to squeak across a run when the Indians do not. And the Braves are hoping that Sane continues to pitch well until darkness, because apparently there was a rule in those days that any game that began in day could not be finished under the lights, which I don't know what exactly.
Oh, interesting.
If you started a game as a day game without the lights, you couldn't finish it up under the lights. I don't know. Another one of those rules. I don't know how long it lasts for, but it lasts, or it's in effect here. The other thing is that the Indians, with Feller pitching so well in a loss in game one, and then with victories in games two, three, and four, they get four really excellent pitching performances, so much so that by the time game five rolls around in Cleveland, they have not had to use their bullpen at all. And that means that nobody in the Indian bullpen, and that includes Satchel Paige, nobody has gotten into the game in relief for Cleveland by the time game five rolls around.
So game five, it's Sunday, October the 10th, 1948. 86,288 is the reported attendance I see here. They broke the record that was set the day before. Obviously, the fans are there expecting to at least have a chance to see. First of all, it's going to be the last game of the year in Cleveland one way or another, but also it's, you know, they have a chance to see Cleveland win a championship. Boston gets three runs in the first inning. They're up 4-1 off of Feller. It's Warren Spahn against Bob Feller is the pitching matchup. It's 4-1 in the third inning. The Indians then get four runs in the bottom of the fourth and briefly take a 5-4 lead. Boston ties it up in the sixth at 5. And then in the seventh, Boston gets six runs to take an 11-5 lead, which holds up as the final. I'm sure you'll have some comments on this, but this is also a game that Warren Spahn didn't start the game. He pitched in relief. He got the win, but he pitched in relief. Satchel Paige did get into the game, so he was the first black pitcher to take the mound in World Series history. I think he pitched like a third or two thirds of an inning, I believe. So not a, not a very long appearance, but the Indians miss out on their chance to wrap it up at home and head back to Boston now, needing one win to win the championship.
And that's exactly right. Paige is the first black player to appear in first black pitcher to appear in a World Series game. Does not give up any runs, does get a balk called on him for wiggling his fingers at one point. And if you listen to the radio broadcast of that game, which is still available, Mel Allen, who's the great Yankee radio play-by-play broadcaster, is doing the game. And he talks about, just before Paige comes in, about how this tremendous ovation is coming. Fans are chanting for Paige to go in the game. And so it certainly doesn't diminish some of the vitriol and the racism that guys, you know, Jackie Robinson most prominently faced. But Satchel Paige, at least, they loved him in Cleveland. They wanted him in the game all the time. So he was beloved by the fans in Cleveland, and they wanted to see him in the game. And he gets this just tremendous ovation in 48 in game five when he goes in the game. And like you said, they lose. They got to go back to Boston for a game six. Another good game in game six. Cleveland wins it 4-3.
Yep, they're up 4-1. They get two runs in the sixth and then one in the eighth to go up 4-1. In the bottom of the eighth, the Braves get a bases loaded load the bases. They get a sack fly. They get a double. It's 4-3. But then Bearden comes or continues in the ninth, gets the throws a scoreless ninth. They win the game 4-3, and the Indians have their world championship and to date last world championship.
Couple of quick sort of I don't know if you'd want to call them cultural notes. This series, much like the previous one, is being broadcast on national television. In a year, the number of television sets has almost quadrupled from 150,000
to 38,
150,000 to 550,000. The Indians win game four behind a really strong pitching performance by a pitcher, but they win the game 2-1 behind a really good game by a pitcher by the name of Steve Gromack, who gives up only one run and seven hits in a complete game of nine innings. And Larry Doby homers off a Sane in the third inning to and it's I think that's probably that's the second run of the game for the Indians, and that's enough to win the game 2-1. There's a picture of Gromack and Doby with basically in an embrace in the locker room, and that's considered a sort of a famous picture because the it's two black, or it's a black and a white player embracing each other in the wake of the game four victory. It shows how Doby had come to be accepted by most of his teammates. And that's sort of that's the 48 Indians. Like I said, Vec, as a result of a divorce, has to sell the team a couple of years later before moving on to St. Louis and then to a couple of stints in Chicago. They stay good. Boudreau lasts as manager for two more years, 89 and 65 and 49 behind both Boston and New York. 92 win team in 1950, 51. Boudreau is gone, but he's replaced by Boudreau actually goes and plays his last season with the Red Sox, not as manager, but just as shortstop. In 51, under Al Lopez, who was another Hall of Fame manager, they win 93 games in both 51 and 52, 53 and 92. And then in 54, they have this record-breaking 111 win season where they, and then unfortunately for them, they go and get swept by the New York Giants in the 54 World Series and don't make it back to the postseason for another 40 plus years.
Yeah, watch the first five. If you're looking for a fill-in of what happened with the Indians between 1954 and, let's say, 1988, you can watch the first few minutes of Major League and get a sense for what happened there.
But they're damn good through 55. They're a 90-plus win team, second place most years, basically all through up until the mid-50s with Lopez as the manager, Doby, Bob Lemon. They bring in another future Hall of Fame pitcher in Early Wynn, who's one of the key pitchers of the 54 team. So before they go into this 40-year drought, they have some really, really good years in the 50s.
Yeah, and they 51, 52, 53, they're a second place team behind those Yankee teams that won the championship every year. You mentioned 54, where they, break all the records for, wins for an American League team. I wanted to point out, by the way, this 48 team, and I can't find who was ahead of them, but fourth lowest team batting average ever for a World Series champion were the 48 Indians. I think the 1906 hitless Wonder White Sox were one of those teams, but it wasn't all teams from that long ago. So yeah, the Indians and just to one more thing, and I think this, but it fits in well, and I think you'd appreciate it. So, they get good again in the mid 90s, go to the World Series in 95, they lose. They go to the World Series in 97, they lose. Heartbreakingly in 97, they have a few down, years, and then they're on their upswing again, and they go to the World Series in 2016, and it's this great series against the Cubs, who also have a 40-year longer drought. But before that series started, there was a video of So we talked about how Braves are the last game, you know, the Indians win game six of the World Series in 1948 at Braves Field in Boston. Well, Braves Field in Boston is now Nickerson Field on the campus of Boston University. The soccer stadium, for the most part, I believe, is what it's mostly used for, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So they did a video, and the funny thing is, I think it's a turf field, so they had to find like the slight bit of it that's dirt. There was a video of BU, I forget, I think it was the BU mascot or something like that.
It was, basically, it was Rhett the Terrier, yeah.
Taking dirt from that field, which was the, you know, it's still like the shell of this, of what Braves Field was, and sending it to the Indians for luck as like, this is the field with, you know, where you won your last World Series, so we're sending you this for luck. And you know, that World Series obviously was, didn't go the Indians way, but it's still one of the greatest game sevens you'll ever see. But you know, here we are still 75 years later, and the Indians, I looked it up at the, from the, to reference it from the beginning, the second longest drought is technically the Texas Rangers, because when they came into the league in 1961, they haven't won a World Series since then. And then there's a few teams who've never won one, but yeah, the of teams who've been around longer than the expansion era, the next closest one is the 79 Pirates, which is 31 years later. So the Indians by a lot now have the longest World Series drought. And you know, When did the Curse of the Bambino thing start being a huge deal in the 80s and 90s? Probably after Buckner, right?
Yeah, after Buckner.
So the, so it was 68 years when the Buckner thing happened for the Red Sox. The Cubs thing probably became a huge deal in the 70s or 80s. Like, the Indians are basically at as long now in terms of it being a big deal. And, you know, they're 10 years away from how long the Red Sox drought was. And you know, they're, it seems so much more recent, but it's getting, you know, it's getting up there into that air that the Red Sox and the Cubs and the White Sox were in.
It really is. It very much is. So why don't we transition here to the Cleveland Browns and,
I get two things. Also in 1948, the AHL Cleveland Barons.
I was just about to mention this.
They did win their league, the Calder Cup, which is, the AHL is still the minor league for the NHL, the highest minor league. So the Cleveland Barons did win the Calder Cup. And the only other team I could find professionally that's anywhere near what we're talking about, and I didn't look, did Cleveland have any kind of Negro League team in the 40s?
They did. Oh, what was the,
I didn't look this one up,
team.
The closest pro basketball team I could find was the NBL Toledo Jeeps, who did not have any kind of a season. They finished in like fifth and they were below 500, but, and Toledo is nowhere near Cleveland, but it's in Ohio, so that was the closest I could get there.
Did they play against the Red Man Tobaccos?
I don't think, I can check. I'll check the 1948 NBL standings for you, okay?
So there actually was a Negro League team, the Cleveland Buckeyes, in the mid-40s, who won two Negro American League championships in 45 and 47, and then a Negro League World Series title in 1945. I think I've looked at them. I think I actually have their team in Strat-O-Matic Baseball. I think I actually have their cards as one of the Negro League Legends teams that I have. I don't believe there's anybody particularly noteworthy on this late, mid to late 40s Cleveland Buckeyes team. Yeah, the Quincy Trope was on the team, who's a, some people think that he's a Negro Leaguer who should be in the Hall of Fame. And then there's a center fielder guy by the name of Sam Jethro, who later had a very not short. He played three full years with the Boston Braves in the 1950s and was National League Rookie of the Year in 1950. So yeah, not necessarily in 48, but there was a good solid Negro League team in the Indians in Cleveland in the mid 1940s.
I looked up the Ohio State Buckeyes football team in 48 to see if they did anything special. They did not. By the way, the 47-48 NBL, Toledo was 22-37. No Redman Tobaccos in that league, but you did have the Sheboygan Redskins. You had the Indianapolis Kautskis. You had the Flint Dow ACs, who managed to go 8-52. And then the Anderson Duffy Packers, among other luminaries. So, Toledo, I think, is like hundreds of miles from Cleveland. I don't think it's anywhere near Cleveland, but it's the closest thing I could find from a pro basketball standpoint.
So a little bit about the Cleveland Browns. They're a member of the All-America Football Conference. We did a whole episode about a year ago on expansion and rival leagues in the we did one on basketball a few years back, and then we did one just last year on professional football. The Browns are a part of the All-America Football Conference, the AAFC. The AAFC is the brainchild of a gentleman by the name of Arch Ward, who is also a sports writer. He's also known for being the guy who came up with the idea for the Major League Baseball All-Star Game in the early 1930s. And he also was key in the founding of the Golden Gloves, the amateur boxing tournament. And again, we did an episode on this, so I don't want to revisit it too much. But the vision for the AAFC is that it's going to be the first sort of truly national professional football league. For basically the whole life of the NFL, it had been focused mostly in the Midwest, a lot of teams in Ohio and Illinois and Michigan, and then on the East Coast, Pennsylvania, New York, a little bit in New England, and then south to Baltimore. They placed a team in Florida in the AAFC, although by 1948, that team is gone. They put two teams on the West Coast, the San Francisco 49ers and the Los Angeles Dons. But the dominant team, the team that wins all four AAFC titles, all four AAFC championship games, is the Cleveland Browns, coached by their namesake, the legendary coach Paul Brown, much like the Indians, featuring a whole wide variety of future Hall of Famers.
Yeah, and the Browns are really the only reason that the All-America Football Conference stays afloat more than, the one season that a lot of these other leagues lasted. Would you say that is the case most likely? Is that without the Browns and the dominance and profile of the Browns, that league probably would have been dead by 1948?
I would say probably so. Yeah, and I think that one of the reasons why the Browns are so good is the presence of Paul Brown, who had been the coach at Ohio State prior to the war. He had gone on then to coach at the Great Lakes Naval Center during his time of military service and put up a really solid record there, and then took over the Cleveland Browns going into the 1946 guy. He's an Ohio guy. He is, I believe, born and raised in Ohio. He'd previously coached at Massillon High School in the in the high school ranks, the Massillon Tigers, who, if you've ever heard our colleague George Bazika, who's from that area, who's also the president of the Pro Football Researchers Association, he talks a lot about the Massillon Tigers and what a powerhouse they are in that part of the country and that part of Ohio in high school football. So he's a guy who's done his time. He's coached, and then they decide they're going to bring him in to coach this team in 1946, the Cleveland Browns. And I guess we should talk about some of the all-time greats that are on this team also.
Yeah, and for the record, the Browns thing wasn't, he didn't come in and say like, oh, I insist the team be named after me. I believe there was a contest held where people were allowed to write in to the newspaper to come up with a name. What did he want to call it? The Panthers, I believe, was his preferred name.
That might be right. And yeah,
Browns ended up winning because of him. So I hopefully this is a place you're okay with starting because it works in. So you mentioned him coaching at that military base. you know, during the war, one of his star players there, the player that this is where he met Marion Motley, was at this military base where he was coaching the team, and Marion Motley was one of his star players. And again, this is, it's important to point out that this is during World War II, so obviously pre Jackie Robinson, and Motley is an African American, and Brown uses him as actually a championship game they're going to be playing, that Motley technically could have been discharged from the military before this game, but sort of voluntarily stayed in so that he could play in this game. And they used the draw play, which was kind of a new invention at the time, to sort of dominate this game with Marion Motley. And when Brown goes to the Cleveland Browns, you know, after the war, he brings in Marion Motley.
There's a modern day NFL writer named Mike Lombardi, who some people are familiar with. And he just came out with a book called Football Done Right. And he has a list of his top 100 NFL players of all time. And he lists Marion Motley as one of the 100 greatest players of all time. The Athletic did something similar when they came out with their best 100 football players of all time about 2 years ago. One of the things is Motley, in addition to being a really, really good running back, just a power guy. And there's this famous video clip of him in black and white, obviously running and having his helmet fall off. And he, in addition to being one of the greatest, you know, running backs of his time, a fullback, he also is considered one of the best linebackers of the time period during this time of two-way football. And you're right, Lombardi had Paul Brown had remembered him from his time at Great Lakes Navy. Similarly, another Hall of Famer, Bill Willis, who is the nose guard, the middle guard on this Browns team, the other African-American Hall of Famer on the team, Brown had coached him at Ohio State. And the story of the reintegration, there's four players in 1946 who reintegrate professional football. There's Willis and Motley with the Browns and the AAFC, and then there's Kenny Washington, and I forget who the fourth one is, in the Los Angeles, with the Los Angeles Rams. The Rams had actually moved from Cleveland after the 45 season, and as a condition of playing at the LA Coliseum, they're required to integrate their team. The two guys, including Kenny Washington, don't do a lot for the Rams. They have a couple good years, but they don't go on to Hall of Fame careers the way Willis and Motley do with the Browns. But I want to talk a little bit about the story of the reintegration of the Browns in 1946. And I'll put this in the show notes. This is from a biography of Paul Brown. Willis, who had played for Brown at Ohio State, like I said, calls Brown and asks him if there's a possibility of catching on with this new Cleveland team. Brown says, "I'll give you a call and let you know." Willis thinks that Brown is just blowing him off. He ends up making an agreement to go play with a team in Montreal in the Canadian Football League. But then a reporter with the Columbus Dispatch in Columbus, Ohio, a guy who has an interesting name, the guy's name is actually Paul Horning. And when I first read this, I thought it was a typo in the book, but then I realized that that it actually is not. This is actually, the guy's name is Paul Horning. He convinces Willis to go to camp uninvited. He shows up at Brown's training camp, and Paul Brown sees Willis and says, "Do you think you can still play football?" And Willis says, "I think so." And Paul Brown says, "Go get a uniform and let us know." And then the next day he shows up and he makes his way onto the team. And then Marion Motley himself, like you said, had expressed interest. He was working in a steel mill and playing semi-pro baseball. And he gets a call from a guy by the name of John Brickles, who's one of Brown's assistants at Paul Brown's instructions, and Motley shows up. People think that probably the thing is that he wants to have two black players on the team for, you know, two guys can room together, that whole type of thing. And Brown says to all of his players, he says, you know, doesn't specifically mention black teammates, or doesn't specifically mention race, but he says, if you can get along with your teammates, or if you can't get along with your teammates, you won't be here. And the Motley and Willis and a couple other guys lead the Browns to the AAFC title in 46, lead them to another title in 47. And going into the 1948 season, they are clearly the cream of the crop of the AAFC. I want to talk a little bit about a couple of the other guys, other future Hall of Famers on that team. But that is the story of the Cleveland Browns and the two great black future Hall of Famers that they bring into the team going into the first year in 1946.
Yeah, you mentioned 46. They go 12-2. They win the championship over the New York Yankees 14-9. 47, they're 12-1-1 again against the Yankees in the championship. They win that one 14-3. So first 2 years there of the AAFC, they are 24-3-1 and have won both championship games.
So there are seven future Hall of Famers on this team in the 1948 season. We already mentioned Motley. We mentioned Bill Willis. They have a guy by the name of Lou Groza, who is a tackle and also a kicker. Groza is an incredible story in that he is on the team from 1946 all the way until 1967. He takes a year off in 1960 for one reason or another. Maybe he temporarily retires. Groza is in the Hall of Fame. He's a 9-time Pro Bowler. Eventually, he stops being a tackle and is just a kicker. He's considered one of the great kickers of the pre-soccer style. He's probably the greatest ever traditional kicker, where they just stand there and take a step up and kick it, as opposed to the soccer style where they take the three steps and kick it, you know, that everybody sees and everybody does now. But Lou Groza plays with the Browns all the way until 1967, after Paul Brown is gone, until he himself is 43 years of age. He ends up winning 4 NFL titles and 4 AAFC titles with the Browns. He is on the team all the way up until the Jim Brown era, and even after that, probably the guy who sees more Cleveland Browns history in over 20 years with the Cleveland Browns. So he is on the team as the starting left tackle and also the kicker of the team. And then they have a center by the name of Frank Gatzke, who is a future Hall of Famer. And then I want to close by talking about the passing attack, because this is probably the first team with a modern passing attack. And that includes two future Hall of Fame receivers in Max Speedy and Dante Lavelli. And then Otto Graham, who is considered still to this day, maybe the greatest, one of the 10 or so greatest quarterbacks in NFL history. When you see lists of greatest quarterbacks of all time, even today, you see Brady, you see Montana, you see Peyton Manning, obviously, and you'll see, you know, some of these guys got Unitas and Staubach. Usually the farthest, some lists you'll see Sammy Baugh, but usually the farthest back you'll see a guy consistently is Otto Graham, who plays 10 years with the Cleveland Browns in 46-55, is in a title game every year in either the AAFC or the NFL, and is considered to be, even to this day, one of the best quarterbacks of all time.
You know, he's the first one that they will consider in any degree a modern quarterback. You know, they're obviously not going to take somebody from the 30s and, you know, where most of it was still running the kind of offense that wouldn't, you know, where basically it was just a rugby style offense, almost, for lack of a better term. You know, and obviously, if you were to watch film of Otto Graham throwing the ball in the 40s, it wouldn't, you know, you wouldn't confuse it with the modern offense, but it's still resembles it more closely than anything before it did, in terms of being a part of an offensive game plan and not just something you did twice a game to throw the other team off balance, or if it was 4th and 28 and you needed to try to do something or you were going to lose the game.
Something else that's interesting about Graham is that he is one of only two players, and you won't always necessarily see him even listed this way, but he's one of only two players to win a championship in two of the four major North American sports. He plays with the, and I just want to make sure I get this right. He plays with the Rochester Royals of the National Basketball League in the early 1946, the 1945-46 season, which is, I guess, it's kind of like the before the NBA has truly started. So it's really kind of a question of how you consider this. But they defeat the aforementioned Sheboygan Redskins to win the National Basketball League title in March of 1946. And a lot of people consider him one of the only two players to win championships in two of the major four professional sports. The other one who's a little bit more legit is Gene Conley, who is a pitcher for the Braves, the Milwaukee Braves in 1947, and is also a role player on the Red Auerbach Celtics teams of the 1950s. The other guy who comes close, obviously, is Deion Sanders, who damn near wins a World Series in 92 with the Braves and has would have been World Series MVP if they had won that World Series. And then also, wins a couple Super Bowls with San Francisco and with Dallas. But Otto Graham is really kind of the anchor of this modern day passing attack. He and Paul Brown create the modern T-formation offense, which is sort of what we know of today with a quarterback and running backs behind him and ends or wide receivers split out. And he's got two Hall of Fame receivers in Dante Lavelli. Dante Lavelli, who has been he's known as Mr. Clutch. And Brown says that Lavelli has one of the strongest pair of hands he's ever seen. When he went up for a pass with a defender, you could almost always count on him coming back with the ball. Lavelli, who's on the Browns for this entire run, he's with them from 46 until 56. And I just want to look at his stats real quick, but he is one of the great early receivers of the 40s and 50s. You know, never receives for 1,000 yards, but numbers that are very, very impressive for the time being. And he is elected into the Pro Football Hall of Fame in 1975. His counterpart is Mac Speedy, Mac with an C, M-A-C, S-P-E-E-D-I-E, who especially during the early days is probably actually a better receiver than Dante Lavelli. In the AAFC days, Mac Speedy does get over 1,000 yards twice, 1146 in 1947 and then 1028 in 1949. The year we're talking about, 1948, he does lead the league in receptions with 58. He's named an All-Pro has 816 receiving yards. The difference between Speedy and Lavelli is that Speedy leaves the team after the 1952 season after some conflicts with Paul Brown, goes to Canada and plays in Canadian professional football for a few years before hanging it up. And it's said that he and Brown don't speak for decades until one or both of them pass away. And there was always kind of a rumor that Brown's influence had kept Speedy out of the Hall of Fame. Speedy is actually not elected into the Hall of Fame until 2020, in the 100th year anniversary of the NFL, when they set up this special committee to sort of sweep through, you know, going all the way back to the 20s, try and get some more of these guys in. And Max Speedy is probably finally elected to the Hall of Fame in that year. But he was widely considered just as good, if not better, than his counterpart, Dante Lavelli, especially in the 40s, especially AAFC days. But it takes Speedy all the way until 2020 to get into the Hall of Fame.
One other interesting tidbit I had here revolving around personnel going into the 48 season. Did you know about this with the quarterback, quarterback they brought in very, very briefly before the 48 season?
You know, it sounds familiar, but why don't you remind me?
So, and I'm seeing a little bit of conflicting reports, but so Y.A. Tittle was signed by the Browns in the offseason between, you know, before the 48 season, I guess right after the 47 season. I'm seeing an interview from Y.A. Tittle from a few years back. He said he told me the Browns thought Otto Graham would only play one more year and that I could learn from him from one season. It wasn't true about Otto. Of course, he played for many years after that. Tittle was getting ready to report to Cleveland's camp when the AFC commissioner notified him he was going to the Baltimore team instead. He decided he wanted more balance in the league, so he took several players from the Browns and the Yankees and then sent them to Baltimore. And by the way, while I'm reading this interview, I have to say, like, because it's a Q&A with Y.A. Tittle from 2009, and they're clearly trying to bait him to say bad things about the current game, and he won't. And I've always heard he's a real classy guy, but like, this thing's like, oh, what do you think of the players today? And he's like, oh, they're fast, they're great athletes. So, like, good for him for not taking that bait there. But, you know, so I guess technically maybe Cleveland traded him away, but it was done in a way that it was clear that they didn't have much of a choice because they needed to redistribute the talent. And Y.A. Tittle will go down as the second biggest acquisition football-wise from Cleveland to Baltimore.
And the first being the team itself.
Entire team, yes.
The other guy who's on this team as a rookie is Ara Parseghian.
That's right, yes.
The future head coach of Notre Dame is on this team. And he, like a lot of future coaches, Bill Walsh, among others, learns at the feet of Paul Brown during this time frame.
And I do have to say the one thing about that that's interesting to me, and I'm trying to pull up exact. You said he was a rookie in 1948.
Correct.
So he was born in 1923. As I just looked it up, he was born in 1923. In that movie, which takes place in the early 70s, Rudy, they portray him as if he's 90 years old. He would have been, what, 49?
Something like that, yeah.
He's basically your age in that movie.
I'm 40, not 49, but fine.
But yeah, don't you get the impression that he's like, when they say, like, oh, Ara Parseghian quit in that, in Rudy, like, they're like, oh, well, he's probably about to die based on the way he's portrayed in that movie. And he wouldn't have even been 50 at the time. But anyway, that's a digression. But yeah, when I saw that name, obviously that's not a name a lot of people have, Ara Parseghian. So it kind of blew me away when I saw that. I was like, oh, wow, I did not know he was on that team.
They finished with a 14-0 record. It's worth noting that the AAFC, at least in this season, actually plays a 14-game season, whereas the NFL is at a 12-game season all the way until the 1960 season. But they'd been 12-2. They'd been 12-1-1 the year before. They go 14-0 in 1948. Paul Brown calls this the best team that he's ever coached. Graham, Speedy, and Motley lead the AAFC in the three major offensive categories: passing, rushing, and receiving. The second best team is probably the fellow Western Conference team, the San Francisco 49ers, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a second. They're 12-2. The East is comparatively weak. In fact, the Baltimore Colts and the Buffalo Bills tie for the Eastern Conference Championship at 7-7 and have to settle it in a one-game playoff, which the Bills win. A lot of people really do feel that the 49ers are the second best team in the All-America Football Conference that year. And I have a book here that's a really good book. I actually just read this while I was on vacation. It's Pro Football Championships Before the Super Bowl. And it tells the story of all whether it's the NFL championship games pre-Super Bowl or the AFC championship games. The two teams that played, this is the Browns and the 49ers, November 14th and 1920 and November 28th, they were 12-2. The Browns had defeated them in games in November by 7-3 points. So a little bit the other way. And not only would the Browns not have been the AFC Western Division champions, but they would not have even won they would not have been undefeated. They would not have finished with that 14-0 record. And other than the 72 Dolphins, they are the only other professional football team to go undefeated and then go on and win a championship game. We all know that the Patriots lost to the Giants in 07, another subject of a Hello Old Sports episode. And we also, I believe it was the Bears in like 41 or 42 were undefeated and then lost in the NFL title game. There's one more interesting anecdote before we get to a little summary of the 48 title game. Branch Rickey is part of a group that purchased the football Dodgers in the AAFC in 1948. And he sort of brings a very baseball mentality to things. And he convinces the Cleveland Browns that they should go on the road for 3 games in 8 days. Mm-hmm. And so in the 1948 season, the Cleveland Browns,
week 11 to 13, they actually played 4 road games in a row to finish the season, but those are weeks 11, 12, and 13.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't even know. Can you consider these weeks if you think about it?
No, I'm yeah. Not really.
And if you look on Pro Football Reference, both games, the last 2 games, are both listed as being week 14. So, and this is impressive. They beat the New York Yankees 21-9 in New York, and then they go all the way to L.A. for a Thursday game, which they don't even make teams do that now. And they beat them 31-14. And then 3 days, and that was Thanksgiving Day, the 25th in Los Angeles. And then 3 days later, they beat the San Francisco 49ers in the aforementioned. So not only do they beat the 49ers, you know, the second best team in the league, they beat them in a road game, having played 2 previous games over the last 6 or 7 days. And then they go back to New York, and a week later they beat the Brooklyn Dodgers. So yeah, they're basically on the road for, you know, it's only 2 weeks, but it's 4 games that they're on the road for.
And one other thing I wanted to bring up, because I was just looking at this, and I could, you know, on Sunday, October 10th,
I was just about to mention this.
Yeah, I'm trying to. The Brown game must have been at night.
It was at 8:30 at night. They moved it to 8:30 at night because there was an Indians World Series game against Boston earlier in the day at Municipal Stadium.
Yeah, and think about it. If they had won that game, they would have won the World Series. They would have won the World Series and then had to clear out so that they could have played a football game 5 hours later on the field. But anyway, that's a digression. But yeah, they were on the road 3 times in 8 days, which I don't think will happen anytime again soon. The players are annoyed enough not having to play every 4th day.
Exactly.
Or once a year on 4 days rest.
So they go to the 48 title game against the aforementioned the Buffalo Bills. The game is played in Municipal Stadium, you know, just as the World Series had been about 2 months earlier. That it's not a particularly close game. It is 49-7. They get touchdowns from Jones, Dub Jones. They get a rushing touchdown from Dub Jones. They get a fumble recovery and then a passing touchdown by Dub Jones, who's the left halfback, Edgar Jones. Motley runs for a TD. Buffalo finally scores 1, but then Motley runs for another TD and another TD after that. And then by that point, they get 1 more touchdown on an interception return in the 4th quarter. Groza kicks 7 extra points. Paul Brown calls this the greatest team that he's ever coached. And they kind of ride off into the sunset. If nothing else, they're definitely the best team in AAFC history. And really one of the greatest teams, even when the NFL a couple of years ago did its 100 greatest teams of all time, this 48 Browns team, even though they were in the AAFC, and the NFL doesn't really like, even now, they don't really like to acknowledge the AAFC. It's not the same as with the AFL where they've sort of embraced it. They kind of like to shove the AAFC off to one side, but this 48 Browns team is a team that can't be ignored. And one of the reasons why this Browns dynasty can't be ignored is that they joined the NFL in 1950, and everybody thinks, and we talked about this a little bit in our previous episode with some of the things that were said by some of the ownership and some of the leadership. I think the commissioner says, you know, it's paraphrased, but it's basically like, call us when you get a football. The 1950 season, their first year in the NFL with basically the same team as they'd had in the AFC, they beat the defending champion Eagles 35-10 on opening night. It's a Saturday night game in Philadelphia. They beat them 35-10. They go on to finish with a 10-2 record. They defeat the LA Rams, who had had a record setting offense in 1950. They go on to defeat them. I actually guessed it a couple years ago on Dana Augusta's Historically Speaking Sports podcast to talk about this game. It's you know, this 1950, the Philly game. And so the fact that they make it to six championship games in their first 6 years in the NFL, I think they win three titles in those 6 years. I think they win the title in 50, 54, and 55, if I'm not mistaken. So for that reason, we're kind of able to look at those championships of the 40s in a much different light, because they did so much once they got to the NFL.
And just since you invoke those Eagles teams, one thing that I thought was interesting, the Eagles had won the NFL championship, but you know, we're not doing great. You know, this is still the 40s, and obviously the NFL is a bigger deal than the AFC, but the NFL is not the NFL. It would be 10 or 15 years later, even, let alone now. The owner of the Eagles proposed a championship game or series with the Browns. So this is the owner of the NFL champion proposing a championship, some sort of championship tournament series, whatever, with a lesser league's champion, was reprimanded by Commissioner Burt Bell and informed that no such thing would be taking place. 1949, the Browns win again. The AFC by then is down to seven teams, so they go down to 12 games because, like you mentioned, they were playing a 14-game season because they were doing a double round robin, basically like soccer leagues do, where you play everybody twice. So that's why they went down to 12 games. The Browns won again. Their overall AAFC record, 52-4-3 in the 4 years the league exists. They are basically the entire reason that there's a merger. The Browns and the 49ers are accepted into the NFL. The Colts are very briefly accepted, not those Colts, but a team that folded almost immediately. And a few years later, there was a Colts. Immediately they thought there was a mistake. They regretted that they accepted the Colts instead of the Bills.
They should have taken the Buffalo team.
Yep. And then technically the Dons merged with the Rams, although not really. And then the other teams were folded. Interestingly enough, you mentioned this 12-0 or this 14-0 team and the undefeated, and whether it would be recognized or not. I see Ohio State Senator Sherrod Brown wrote a letter to the NFL commissioner asking him to acknowledge, basically to consider, the Pro Football Hall of Fame acknowledges this team as an undefeated team, but the NFL doesn't, which is interesting. And you know, when I saw, as I was looking through this, you know, when there was a lot of articles from February of 08, I actually found an article.
Yeah, that's, I saw that too. Yeah.
Unfortunately, it's paywalled, but there's an article in the New York Daily News on February 3rd, 2008, which was the day of Super Bowl 42 when the Giants played the Patriots, basically saying, we might have another team in the club by the end of tonight, but don't forget about the 48 Browns and all that. And then obviously the next day, I have the New York Daily News from the next day, and there's nothing in it about the 48 Browns, unfortunately, or not unfortunately, but I just thought it was interesting that a lot of the articles were from around then. The Browns, you know, they were an unstoppable machine in the AAFC. But this was the best team. I think, like you said, given that they won right away in the NFL, people feel more comfortable. It's almost like I said with Page, where since he did well, albeit briefly, at 42 in the major leagues, you can quantify it. You can quantify how good this Browns team was because they kept doing it in the NFL. There might have been 10 teams in the NFL better than anyone else in the AAFC, but the Browns were better than anybody in the NFL.
And I was wrong, by the way. The NFL Network actually does not include this team in their top 100. They have the 50 Browns there, which is their first year in the NFL, and that's actually, they're pretty high. They're 25th of all time, and they've got some of the other teams. I think they've got they got 54 in there, so they've got a couple of those, you know, the Graham Motley, but everybody sort of says that if you look at it, you know, if you stipulate that every year should be taken equally, the team of the 40s was the better team. That's when, and that's certainly when Motley was probably at its best. It's when Max Speedy was at its best. And I was glad to see Speedy get his recognition for the Hall of Fame a couple of years ago. So yeah, it's, you know, entire documentaries have been done about the futility of Cleveland sports in the modern and even the not quite so modern era in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. And there's a lot of stories there. And it also kind of, it couples up nicely, you know, story-wise with the decline of the economy and industry in the city in a lot of ways. But late 40s, 1948, not only was the city booming, but the two teams in the two major league sports, really, I guess the hot NHL was around in those days too, but the two by far most popular sports, most popular professional sports in the country, Cleveland sat atop in 1948, whether it was with legendary coaches, integration, you know, all-time greats with Feller, Graham, Motley, all these guys. So, you know, when we focus specifically on a city on this show, it usually tends to be New York or sometimes Philly, and we've, you know, some others at times, but Cleveland 1948 is a year to remember.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a cool little snapshot, and again, not one that you hear a ton about. But you know, the Browns have obviously won since 48, although not since, what was it, 64 was their last one.
64
was it? You know, not since 64. Obviously, the Indians still have not won, and Cleveland went on that long drought that was broken by the Cavaliers, but. Yeah, they, like you said, it was a brief moment in time, but they were the center of power with the two biggest professional sports in the country at the time.
And this came a little later. This might not have necessarily been 48, but Don Shula played on these teams and studied under Paul Brown. Lou Saban, no relation to Nick Saban, but Lou Saban, who went on to coach the Buffalo Bills and the Oakland Raiders in the AFL, he goes to the Patriots and the Bills, Saban, not the Raiders and the Bills. So that, you know, Weeb Eubank was an assistant on these teams, went on to win titles with the Colts and the Jets. So lots of figures had their formative years with the Browns of the 1940s.
Shula was there 51 and 52.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, hopefully we get some Cleveland listenership out of this one, and hope, you know, regardless of where you are, we hope you all enjoyed this one. And as I've said before, next time we'll be back with something totally different. But until then, I'm Dan Newman.
And I'm Andrew Newman. Goodbye, old sports.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Join George Bozica, the president of the PFRA, and myself, John Bozica, each month for the Professional Football Researchers Association official podcast. We'll discuss the history of the game, the many names of the game, and so many different things for you, making the history of football not only entertaining, but fun at the same time, as we join you on the Sports History Network on the official PFRA podcast.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.